Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Thanks for joining me on this episode of Behind the Lines. I'm Arthur Snell. Before we get started, I want to tell you about a podcast that I'm really enjoying at the moment. Disorder is a weekly podcast from Goalhanger, the makers of The Rest is Politics. It's tackling the really big questions like, how did the world get so disordered? What are the fundamental principles behind our current era of geopolitics? And how do seemingly disparate challenges from AI to climate change to wars in the Middle East and Ukraine to tax havens to unregulated cyberspace, how do they all interact with each other and feed into our era? So check out the link in the show notes to follow the podcast immediately.
So the most extraordinary thing happened that people had, who had spent, you know, the previous however many months trying to escape, post-war Europe, place where, you know, they had been facing death all the time, suddenly found themselves back at the port of Hamburg, where they were disembarked by 1,000 British troops, helped by 1,500 German policemen, with brass band music playing over a tannoy in the background to drown out all the screaming.
Welcome to the second of these special two episodes on the history of the Israel-Palestine conflict with the historian James Barr. If you haven't already listened to the first episode, that's from last week, I'd strongly advise you to do that first, otherwise this might seem a bit confusing. In last week's episode, we looked at the origins of the Israel-Palestine issue, reaching back all the way to the Ottoman occupation of Palestine in the 16th century, and then following that story through the birth of Zionism, increasing Jewish emigration to what was then Palestine, followed by the Sykes-Picot Agreement and the Balfour Declaration. And perhaps at the heart of that story was a colonial conflict for control of that territory between Britain and France, where the interests of the indigenous inhabitants of that region were barely considered at all. This week, we pick up the story just at the end of the hideous events of World War II, and particularly the Holocaust. Jews who've survived those awful events are displaced across Europe, and understandably not at all keen to return to their original homes. Instead, these survivors of the Holocaust sought to migrate to Palestine with the aim of starting a new life in what had been, historically, the land of Israel. But as we'll hear, there was nothing straightforward about that ambition. In particular, the British colonial authorities in Palestine were extremely reluctant to allow the Jews' arrival. So here's James picking up the story in the late 1940s as Jewish militancy is targeting British colonial officials as they seek to limit the ability of Jews to come to what is now Israel. So it's important that we start to talk about the organizations and entities that the Jewish people were putting together in the devastating aftermath of the Holocaust in order to facilitate this movement, but also armed organizations, organizations that could be described as terrorist organizations. So we're talking about a very chaotic situation, 1945, 6-7. What was happening in Europe at that time?
So there'd always been the Haganah, or at least for many years. That was essentially a defensive militia that was set up to protect Jewish settlements in Palestine, particularly after the Arab revolt had kicked off in 1936. And by 1938 or so, that had turned its sort of energies to people smuggling. So at that point, it was still possible to get people out, but there were strict, increasingly strict British limits on immigration. So in 1939, the British imposed a limit of 15,000 Jewish people per year for the next 5 years, so maximum of 75,000 people. And they then, after that, they sort of did things on a kind of ad hoc basis. So they were very, you know, at a point when the scale of the Holocaust started to become clear during 1942, I suppose, and it was publicly acknowledged by Anthony Eden in Parliament in December 42. At that time, Britain was still had very, very strict limits on who could actually come, and Jews who did come and were intercepted were then sent off to places like Mauritius, where they were, you know, incarcerated for the rest of the war.
Yeah.
That caused massive anger, as you hardly be surprised to know. The result of that was the creation of two groups. There was the Stern Gang, which named after Avram Stern, who was a sort of kind of poet, essentially. He started a terrorist campaign in 1942 at a time when there was very little sympathy for what he was doing. And he was rather quickly rounded up because he made plenty of enemies in a short space of time. And he was essentially shot while resisting arrest, or shot whilst escaping, and he was found in a flat in Tel Aviv. And the British kind of clapped themselves on the back and said, "Oh, well done, we've fixed that." But actually, the Stern Gang carried on, and two of its members were responsible for the assassination of Britain's top man in the Middle East, Lord Moyne, in 1944. So they hadn't gone away. They were getting support from the French, meanwhile, because the disaffected elements of the Vichy government in Beirut had realised that they could make common cause with the Zionist terrorists, because they both saw Britain as being the great local problem. So there was a French intelligence officer called Colonel Alessandri, who ran something called the Bureau Noir, so the Black Office, and he was spotted having sort of lunch, breakfast, whatever, with known terrorists, in French controlled territory, and eventually the British managed to get him chucked out, but he never really got a rap on the knuckles. I eventually managed to see his personal file in the French archives, and it was quite clear that what he did enjoyed sanction right up at the top level in the French government.
So this is a bizarre case again of sort of your enemy's enemy, in that the extremely anti-Semitic Vichy regime was also supporting Jewish militancy against the British in Palestine.
Exactly right. And weirdly enough, Stern himself wondered whether he would get Nazi support for what he was doing. It was all incredibly complicated and kind of counterintuitive. On the other hand, the other group there was the Irgun, which I'm trying to remember when it was set up. I think it was just pre-war, but it didn't do anything until essentially after the war.
Yeah.
So when it became clear in 1945 that the immigration restrictions weren't going to be relaxed, despite the fact there was now a Labour government, which had professed itself up until it took power to being, you know, pro-Zionist, and people like Hugh Dalton, who ended up as Chancellor of the Exchequer, making very, very pro-Zionist comments in the run-up to the election. But once they took power, well, firstly, Bevin became Foreign Secretary, and he was by no means pro-Zionist. In fact, many people think he was anti-Semitic himself. But he took the view that there were lots of people who had had a bad time in the war, and that everyone needed to form an orderly queue and gradually, you know, everyone would be sorted out. The British were quite slow at understanding that Jews who'd survived the Holocaust were not going to want to go back to where they'd lived before, either because those places were essentially nothing and everybody else had been wiped out, or because they still faced anti-Semitism there. That, you know, just because the Nazis had been defeated didn't mean that anti-Semitism had magically disappeared. And there was still plenty of evidence that you can read about of rife anti-Semitism after the war. So people didn't want to go home. The British didn't appreciate that. And at the end of 1945, there was the creation of something called the Jewish Resistance Movement, which essentially brought all these organizations together under the umbrella of the Jewish Agency, which tried to pretend it had nothing to do with any of this. And in the background, David Ben-Gurion, who was the most militant, I think, of the Zionists, really, he was sort of, you know, behind the scenes organizing stuff. But the British never really, even though they got very, very close to sort of intelligence breakthroughs, which would have shown them what was going on. They had quite good interception of communications, but they never really understood the nature of what they were fighting. Meanwhile, the French government were quite happy to let the Irgun in particular, not the Stern gang, not so much, but the Irgun were given a base on French soil, and they had been helping again to organize emigration. There were lots of people who had, who'd survived the Holocaust coming west. There were pictures of people up in French railway stations, for example. You know, all these people, have you seen my relatives? Sort of, you know, imagine a bit like these posters that have been recently with the hostages. Imagine stations full of pictures of people's relatives saying, have you know, has anyone seen these people last seen, you know, 6 years before or something?
Yeah.
The Irgun made their headquarters. It's a very, I forget what the name of the hotel is. It's on the Rue de Sèvres. It's a sort of turn of the 20th century, very flash hotel, which has only relatively recently been done up. But that was their HQ. They made absolutely no effort to sort of conceal where they were. And the French turned a blind eye to what they were doing. And what they were doing was sending letter bombs to British politicians. And the French said, that's okay, as long as you don't post them. Mustn't have a French postmark on them. So the letter bombs were constructed in France and then couriered over the border, either to Turin in Italy or into Belgium, where they were then sent to British officials. So Anthony Eden received one. They were very thin. It was just like an envelope, but it had plastic explosive inside it. And I think Eden went to Eton, and he went back to his old school for the sort of that summer celebration that the school has every year, and carried this letter bomb around with him for the entire day in his briefcase until finally someone got word to him that there'd been this series of letters had arrived, and he wasn't to do anything to open it. So close shave
for Eden. But I'm trying to understand. So obviously France at this point is not Vichy France. It's liberated France. It's General de Gaulle's France. What was their objective in sort of allowing this terrorist movement to flourish?
Well, I think it was revenge, as simple as that. And I know some people think that that's a rather extreme view, but the other day I was rereading a book by a man called Jacques Soustelle, who was de Gaulle's head of intelligence and famous anthropologist. And it's called The Long March of Israel. And I'm rereading my notes just because they happened to pop up when I did a quick search for something completely different. And he says very, very clearly in the book that it was a policy of revenge, because the other thing that had been going on that we haven't even covered is that Britain was trying to help the Arab nationalists in Lebanon and Syria gain independence. Because just before that war that I talked about in 1941, against when Britain fought the French sort of for the last time, the British had tried to make their job easier by forcing de Gaulle to issue this promise of independence to Lebanon and Syria. And of course, once de Gaulle got power, the last thing he was going to do was honour that, because it was going to be a gift to his opponents. And, you know, Vichy government was going to say, well, you're just handing over bits of France.
Yeah. So of course there's no assumption of, you know, with history, we look back and think that decolonization was a necessary outcome of World War II, but the people running the countries that were colonizers didn't think that at the time.
No, exactly. Absolutely not. De Gaulle was all set to carry on where he'd left off. But we sent in this man called Edward Louis Spears, who was a mate of Churchill and had been de Gaulle's main sponsor. So he was the man who dragged de Gaulle by his coat lapels aboard an aircraft in Bordeaux in 1940 to get into London. And the two of them are pictured in the Savoy the following lunchtime, enjoying a kind of half a carafe of red wine and a cigar. But the problem was that as de Gaulle became more and more awkward, Spears, who was another Conservative MP and a bit washed up, realised that his reputation was on the line. And so he's sort of the worm turned, and he went back to Lebanon, where he essentially sided with the Lebanese and the Syrian nationalists and helped organise or helped support their successful election campaigns in 43. Well, the French knew all about this. They had a spy inside Spears' office. They knew exactly what was going on. And so, you know, they wanted their revenge.
Yeah. So we have the Ergun operating out of Paris, carrying out different types of operations, including the bombing in 1946 of the British Embassy in Rome. And I mention that because if you visit Rome today, you'll see that the British Embassy is perhaps unexpectedly for that historic city, a rather modernist, boxy creation. I think it's Basil Spence, who was, you know, a distinguished 20th century architect, probably a bit out of fashion now. It's not really what you expect for a British embassy in a city like Rome, but that's because the embassy was blown up in 1946.
That's right. And I'd actually forgotten that episode. And it's, yeah, exactly. It was, this was a campaign that it was, yes, it wasn't confined. It certainly wasn't confined to Palestine. It was, it hit London. There were bombs went off in London. A woman called Betty Knut, I think, K-N-O-U-T. I'm not quite sure how you pronounce her, but she'd been a courier in the French resistance. She ended up working for the Ergun, and she took a bomb and left it in the sort of basement loo in the colonial office, having managed to get in there saying that she desperately needed a wee. And so she left the bomb there. I can't remember quite why it failed. The British actually initially, what I've written in the book, it turns out not to be true, because there's been more recently, there's been archives released that show that actually the reason they gave for the bomb failing to go off was a disinformation, because they wanted to conceal the real reason why it had failed. There was some technical reason why the bomb makers had got things wrong. But anyway, that bomb didn't go off, but there were others that did. And in fact, I mean, there was another man, Roy Farron, who is involved in another scandal where he had kidnapped a young Jewish lad and murdered him. And his brother got sent a bomb. So they both had the initial R. And his brother was sent a bomb, concealed, I think, as a sort of complete works of Shakespeare, which killed him.
Yeah. And the Ergun is doing this in order to change the British stance on immigration to Palestine. But at the same time, of course, you have non-violent, the role of the Jewish agency is very important. Could you explain a bit about what that is?
So the Jewish agency was there, increasingly a state within a state, really, in Palestine, taking on more and more functions, surreptitiously organising a lot of what was going on, but in a way that was deniable. And their headquarters were in West Jerusalem, right, high up in West Jerusalem.
But formally, it's a kind of charitable organisation, isn't it?
That's
stage.
Right. I mean, it was sort of set up. It was set up to sort of ease the way for Jewish immigrants to Palestine from from 1920 onwards. So it's you know, its origins and purpose were entirely genuine. And but it was sort of increasingly just having more and more power. It just understood what was going on. It had extraordinarily good intelligence. It understood exactly what was going on inside the British administration and so on. And eventually the British were determined, they sort of realised that what was going on, they knew there was some sort of connection between the terrorism that was going on and the agency. And so eventually they launched an operation to try and, to make the connection, the British were trying to show the Americans the key thing through this time was trying to persuade the Americans to take things seriously and to understand what they were up against. Obviously, there was lots of support, sympathy for Zionism in America. There was lots of fundraising going on in the United States for Palestine at this time. Support for the illegal immigration that was going on, that was being organized, and boats were being bought in the United States and then used to ship Jewish refugees to Palestine. So the British were determined they needed to sort of show that there was a dark side to all this, and that the, you know, the agency and others were all tied up in the armed resistance that they were facing.
Yeah.
So they raided the agency one Saturday morning. So, you know, the Jewish Sabbath, they launched this raid on the agency, and they took everything out of it. They took all the paperwork, and they took it off to the King David Hotel, which was still there, was the headquarters of the British administration in Palestine at that time. There was a whole wing of the hotel that was the High Commission, essentially, with the High Commissioner working there and so on. And so they took all this paperwork away. Well, of course, the people in the, you know, people on the other side, on the Jewish side, realized, they thought, God, what have they found? What kind of incriminating stuff might there be there? And so fatefully, they took the decision then to attack the hotel.
Right. And it's, we should talk about that, because that is one of the most famous or even infamous sort of episodes of this part of the story, the King David Hotel bombing, in which 91 people were killed. So explain that to our listeners.
So the hotel was the HQ of the British administration, and so it was the place that all the paperwork from the agency had been taken to. The Zionists wondered whether they might be able to sort of disrupt, you know, to disrupt the sort of analysis of all that paperwork and conceal what was actually going on. And so a group of terrorists who would all disguised as Arabs, I think there was one man wearing a sort of Sudanese uniform, there was a milk round. They had milk trains. So this, by this point, the King David Hotel was fairly heavily fortified. But they got in. They were disguised as milkmen, I think, and they wheeled a series of metal churns into a basement light nightclub in the hotel, which was under the wing where the British High Commission's offices were. The nightclub had been kept open against security advice because the situation was really so depressing there that somebody in authority said, look, we've really got to keep this place open because it's really the only place that people can relax. And anyway, the milk churns containing all the high explosive were all wheeled in. At that point, things all become rather unclear because the Zionists said that they issued a telephone warning, and they claimed that the British ignored it.
Yeah.
The French got a telephone warning. They had somewhere just round the corner. They opened all the windows to reduce the effect of, flying glass, and then denied that they had any kind of warning. But there was obviously something going on.
Yeah.
Anyway, the bomb went off. 91 people were killed, as you say. And of course, as with a lot of these things, most of them, you know, were of peripheral importance to the government of Palestine, but, you know, crucial to the running of the High Commission. So drivers, waiters, all this sort of ordinary people who died as a result of all this. But it was an absolute body blow for the British. I think that, you know, psychologically absolutely disastrous for the people running the country, many of whom had been working there for years and years. A bit like, imagine if you're a British diplomat now who'd worked in Europe all your career, in the EU, in multilateral diplomacy. There was a whole generation of people who had worked in Palestine who, whilst we see the motives as rather, you know, cynical now, in the way of people bound up in things at that time, did in many cases honestly believe that they were trying to, you know, bring peace, do good, all the rest of it, and felt that the British Empire was a force for good, no matter how we might see that now. So these people have been, you know, they might have been there since the 20s. They had spent their whole career there, and then suddenly they're faced with this, you know, this kind of explosion of violence. In the 1940s.
Well, I was going to say that that event was an example of terrorism having a desired political effect, because it caused a collapse in the will of the British to continue to sort of run the mandatory Palestine that they, you know, that they had since World War One, and really to kind of walk away and sort of leave it to be someone else's problem.
Exactly. I mean, it's a successful example of terrorism, and there are various good books on this, one by David Hoffman, which came out since I wrote A Line in the Sand. But the other book that's very interesting is Ronan Bergman's book, Rise and Kill First, about the Israeli policy of targeted assassinations, because he puts this policy in this historical context. Because one of the things that the Zionists were so effective at doing in the 1940s was killing very specific people. So there were these massive bombings, yeah, but there were also targeted assassinations of, you know, the Hebrew speakers. There weren't large numbers of British. You had the languages. They didn't know, they didn't speak Hebrew. There weren't many of them, and the Zionists were ruthless at identifying exactly who these people were and murdering them, meaning that the British, you know, just didn't really have a clue about what was going on. And Bergman's point is, you know, this was hugely successful in the 40s. It led ultimately to Israeli independence. It certainly, you know, brought the mandate to an end faster than the British would have liked.
Yeah.
And that policy carried on. And of course, you know, its consequences have been with us ever since.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. We move quite quickly from what is a British imperial administration to a very brief period of the United Nations itself, an organization that's only existed for a couple of years, trying to organize the transition, if you like, to the State of Israel and its formation. Can you talk us through that? That moment, and also perhaps having regard to, at this point, really quite large numbers of people now coming to what becomes Israel. And you mentioned earlier in this discussion the Exodus ship. It's probably time to bring that back into the story.
Yeah, so 1947, the year after the King David Hotel bombing, was one of these years when there are multiple things happening at once, and it's quite hard to tell it as an understandable story.
Yeah.
In February, the British referred the whole question of Palestine to the United Nations. And in the light of, say, Indian independence later that year, you might think this is the sign of Britain giving up and,
yeah,
you know, waving the white flag. But actually, they hadn't at that point. There was still this hope that they might be able to find essentially a UN mandate to stay there. What the British wanted to do was get the UN to say Britain should run this place, and that would give them, you know, a new reason to do justification.
Yeah, that's a raison d'être. Yeah,
credit. You know, exactly. That was credible in international law. So at the time when they put it to the UN, they you know, they still hope that they might be the answer to the question that they were asking, effectively.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Please. But in the meantime, that year, various things went wrong. And I think the key one is the Exodus, which was a ship that in a previous life, it had been a pleasure cruiser on the Chesapeake Bay. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it. It was a pretty dilapidated vessel. It had seen better days, partly because during the war it had been requisitioned and used as a sort of military barracks. So it had probably not been looked after very well. It eventually made its way back to the United States, having spent the war off Devon, I think. And It was bought by the Zionists using a front company, and they had it refitted. They had the engine souped up. And the aim was then to take it to France, pick up passengers, and then try and run the gauntlet of sort of British Coast Guard operations off Palestine. What traditionally these operations did was simply to try and beach the ship in very shallow water. Everyone would climb out, get out somehow, and they would just simply, you know, disappear ashore. There's a very, very famous photograph of this happening where the ship is sort of kind of beached offshore.
Yeah.
There's a whole load of people sunbathing on the beach, and there are people wading ashore where they'll just sort of, you know, merge into the crowd and get away.
And that's the start of their life in Israel.
Exactly. That's it. And they, you know, people certainly once they were on the beach, no one was going to grasp them up. So that was the plan. But the Haganah who bought the ship, actually, they didn't really expect that to happen. And the reason we know they didn't expect that to happen was because of who they put on the ship. They wanted this ship to cause a rumpus. And they got about 4,500 people on board in the port of Sète, the French southern coast. A kind of disproportionate number of those people were pregnant women or mothers with very young children, very old people and the sick. So the aim was, you know, it was designed to elicit an emotional response when, exactly as they expected, the British then rammed the ship in international waters, which they weren't supposed to do.
Off
Palestine, they towed it into the port of Haifa. They offloaded everybody at gunpoint, and there is a photo of a woman pushing a pram down the quayside, you know, surrounded by British paratroops.
Yeah.
So, you know, this, and then they were put on another ship, and they were shipped back to France because the French had rather disingenuously said, "Well, if you do send them back, you may be able to, you know, return them to sender." This is the whole policy of refoulement that we've heard a little bit about over the last few days.
Yeah.
Of course, all the refugees sent back to France. Very, very few of them agreed to disembark in France. They didn't want to get off there, despite the fact the British threatened to take them on to Hamburg if they didn't get off there. And when they didn't, that's what the British did. So the most extraordinary thing happened, that people who had spent, you know, the previous however many months trying to escape, post-war Europe, place where, you know, they had been facing death all the time, suddenly found themselves back at the port of Hamburg, where they were disembarked by 1,000 British troops, helped by 1,500 German policemen.
Wow.
With brass band music playing over a tannoy in the background to drown out all the screaming. And when they were put back on the ship in Haifa, the UN commission that had been appointed after the British said, "Please come and investigate this problem," the UN Commission members of that were all standing on the quayside. You can see them. They are no more than 10 yards from the ship as it is in port, looking, you know, at what's going on. And so not surprisingly, the UN Commission, declared that there was no future for Britain in Palestine. And at that point, that got the clock ticking, because what they said at that stage was that it needed to be partitioned into two states, a Jewish state and an Arab state, with an international zone in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And I suppose the British could have stayed on, but they realised that this was unenforceable. They had proposed partition in the 1930s, and that had produced storms of protest. There was no way the British were going to hang around to see if they could enforce what they thought was a naive UN plan. And so I think October that year, they announced that they would leave in May 1948, come what may.
Yeah.
In November 1947, the UN then voted on the plan, and they voted in favour of it. So they, at that point, a Jewish state got the international seal of approval, because it got the two-thirds vote that it needed.
Yeah. And under international law, that remains the sort of accepted status, albeit it is nothing like what is actually happening on the ground.
Yes, exactly. I mean, so the UN plan granted Israel, as it became, 55% of the old Palestine mandate. So the territory of Palestine, they were going to get 55% percent of that. But then in the war that followed, the Jews, the Israelis, got half as much again. So they took over another sort of 25% of the territory from the Arabs. And of course, at the same time, they had done a deal with the Jordanians behind the scenes. King of Jordan, Abdullah, had cut a deal so that he would invade the West Bank in 1948 and take that over. And the West Bank was Jordanian controlled until the 67 war.
Yeah. So that war, so Israel has had to fight several wars throughout its period of existence, and it began with the war in 48. Who was Israel fighting?
Everybody, or at least all its neighbours. It was fighting Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, and I think the Iraqis were there as well. So it was, you know, existential for Israel, and I think that's the critical thing that you have to have in mind, because this was like all wars, it was appalling. And like all wars, there were atrocities that happened, and some infamous ones in there, and which people tried to deny, but I think actually it's far better to try to explain it. And the explanation, I think, pretty clearly is that the Israelis were faced with, you know, they were way outnumbered by the armies of their Arab neighbors.
Yeah.
And so they did everything that they could to were fighting absolutely for their lives, having many of them just managed to escape, escape the Holocaust in Europe. It's the background of the Holocaust that helps explain this. So that they, in fact, they exaggerated some of what they'd done. The sort of atrocities at the time, it was worth exaggerating those, because the other thing that they did, and the other crucial consequence of the war, was the number of refugees, Palestinian refugees, that it created, as yes. many as 750,000. And the reason they wanted to exaggerate what they'd done was they were hoping that it would cause terror, and it did. And people
terror that would result in people fleeing,
people leaving, exactly. As, yes. Frankly, they wanted people to leave with as little actual physical pressure as possible, and that is what happened.
And of course, in the Arabic language, there's a word Nakba and Nakba, which means the catastrophe. But before these events, it didn't have a particular resonance. But it is now come to be the word that Palestinians and other Arabs use to sort of summarize these events.
That's right. Because, yes, I mean, everybody who the Palestinians were forced from their homes, places that they'd often lived for many, many generations, in places like Jaffa and Haifa, particularly the very densely populated areas of the coast, and they were forced into the West Bank, but also into Lebanon and Syria and the Gaza Strip as well, and by and large they haven't come back.
Yeah. So I want to talk about that a bit, but before we get there, just briefly, under the original sort of UN proposal prior to this war, what was supposed to have happened? Because presumably there wasn't supposed to be the displacement of this many people, but clearly Israel needed to exist as a state.
No, I mean, what the UN proposal cut sort of Palestine into six different bits, and three of them were going to be Jewish and three of them were going to be Arab, and it's quite complicated to describe them. You really have to have a look at a map to see, but they were sort of twisted together, so there were various points at which the territories all touched each other, so it would be possible to make a journey through the three Arab territories or through the three Jewish territories, through contiguous territory, but they were going to be these sort of crossroads at various points. Well, of course, I mean, it looked all right on paper and it sounded all right in theory, but those places also saw, extreme violence as during the war, as the Israelis tried to sort of control them and take them over. So it looked good, but in practice, it wasn't workable.
Yeah. So we get to the end, and as you mentioned, you have the West Bank, which is the bit from Jerusalem going eastwards towards the Jordan River and the Dead Sea, and then you have the Gaza Strip. And given what's happening right now, let's talk a little bit about Gaza. Why was Gaza right from the beginning seen as a sort of a key area for the Arabs, and what's its significance in the wider territory?
Well, so, I mean, it was an area where there was a concentration of Arab settlement. There weren't really large numbers of Jewish people living there, I think I'm right in saying. So under one of the earlier proposals, I think it was the 1936 British proposal, it was going to go to the Arabs already. So it was a logical place to go. The Egyptians took it over during the war. They ran Gaza for the next few years. So it was logical. It was a logical place to go. If you go right into the deep history, it was always somewhere that had resisted Jewish rule. So, I mean, we're now back in 200 BC with the Hasmoneans, hugely ambitious Jewish dynasty who had taken over Judea, as it was then, as the ruling sort of Greek Seleucids imploded. And the Hasmoneans tried to expand the state of Judea, and they took over Galilee, for example, where Jesus came from, and forcibly converted people there. And they tried to do the same thing in Gaza, but they never succeeded. The Gazans really sort of pushed back against them. And interestingly, Gaza remained a pagan sort of city, really up until about 400 AD. There's a report of a bishop. In about 400 AD, finally got permission from the Pope to go in there very heavy-handedly and to destroy this big temple that there was.
Right.
There was there. So there's always been this going right back, and not just Arab versus Jew or Muslim versus Jew. It goes back. It's sort of deeper than this. It was a hugely prosperous place because of the frankincense trade a very long time ago. But it had retained an Arab identity, so it's an important place. And of course, there are now millions of people living there.
Yeah. So you mentioned effectively that the war comes to an end. There's a sort of armistice is agreed, and you have Palestinian refugees, many in the West Bank, many in Gaza, but many in neighbouring countries, notably Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon, where they remain to this day. And of course, we're talking historic events, so that they have now, children and grandchildren, probably great-grandchildren, who are of that status, all of whom see themselves as displaced people with a right of return to what is now Israel.
That's right. So the 700,000 or 750,000 refugees in 1948, I think, are now 6 million people.
Yeah.
That's the number of people who claim refugee status. With every generation, bearing in mind how small this territory is, the idea of a right of return, of course, is different from actually returning, the practicalities of it become more and more difficult to achieve.
I'm conscious of the time. I want to try and sort of surge forward a little. The state of Israel is established, but Israel then has to fight two more sort of existential wars, 1967 and 1973, and arguably has never stopped having to fight different types of sort of militancy and terrorism. The survival of the state of Israel at this stage is presumably not by any means guaranteed. As a historian looking back, at what point do you sort of see that Israel has more or less secured its basic territory, or is that still an unfolding process?
That's a brilliant question, because I think people would say that the 67 war, the perception would be that the 67 war changed things completely, I can't think of the exact, the distance, but the distance between the Mediterranean coast and the westernmost bit of the West Bank up in the north is 10 miles. I don't know, maybe a little bit more than that, but it's very, very small.
I think it is. I'm looking at a map. It's 10 miles.
Okay. Yeah. It's a very small amount. There's a sort of a story that Isa Weitzman, who was, I think he ended up as president of Israel at one point, but he was the head of the Israeli Air Force in the 60s. So he was someone, he could obviously fly. And he was sort of very, he was also a real hawk, but he was very, very aware. If you flew, you could see just how, you know, how marginal,
how thin this territory
exactly.
is.
This is the thing, you know, and that sort of sense of we could be driven into the sea, you know, is there, particularly if you can see that. So I think I'd agree with that 67 is the moment, because clearly then Israel expanded into, you know, took over all of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and Sinai for a while, and the Golan Heights. So it changed. I'm not convinced. The Golan Heights were always seen as a sort of issue of prestige rather than actually being that important land, or even that important for water. But of course, the problems that Israel faces in terms of making peace come from that moment too, because by winning the war, they took over Palestinian territory. That triggered a wave of settlement activity, it seems to have only got accelerated in recent years. And so, in a sense, I think although territorially it changed, you know, it made Israel sort of more secure, I don't think it's really changed the sort of the existential question, which is, you know, can Israel find find peace with its neighbors that brings a sense of inner security to its people? And I don't think that war has achieved that.
No. Well, I mean, the events of the last couple of months, in a way, sort of remind us of that in a tragic way. Clearly, Israel faced huge enmity and threats from the Arab nations surrounding it, albeit over time it has managed, you know, to make peace with Jordan and Egypt, albeit, you know, again, it's a very delicate peace. But the Palestinians themselves, it took them a bit of a while to sort of get organized, and eventually you have this entity, the PLO, led by Yasser Arafat. What significance does this have in the story?
The significance is, I suppose, it's really the Palestinians taking matters into their own hands. Arafat, of course, set up Fatah, first of all, in 59, really as a result of the failure of Nasser, I suppose. I think that's the right way to frame it. You know, there were great hopes that Nasser would do something. Nasser was actually extremely cautious. He didn't want to have a war with Israel. It was always tomorrow would be better, and you know, we must be prepared. Arafat set up Fatah. Nasser set up the PLO as a sort of drag anchor to try to stop the Palestinians doing anything too precipitate.
Yeah,
and but the result was a rising amount of violence, because the Syrians were very willing to back Fatah, partly to poke a stick in Nasser's eye. So that, you know, the Palestinian cause then became a kind of football at different, particularly Syria and Egypt used to sort of try and kind of score points against each other. And I think that's the main takeaway. Arafat, took over the PLO in the 60s and sort of established control over it, and then initially used Jordan or the West Bank as a base, and that helped precipitate the 67 war, forcing the PLO into Lebanon. And then that brings us in a way into a story which is very similar to today's conflict, because you had, you know, atrocities. The big one was 1978. There was this bus hijacking in Tel Aviv, where the Palestinian terrorists had come from Beirut, and the Israelis were under very, very considerable public pressure at home to do something. So they invaded Lebanon.
Yeah.
They were warned off by Carter, because Carter was trying to bring peace between Israel and Egypt, and he got his peace. And the Israelis then invaded again in 1982 and got bogged down in this long war in Lebanon, and they only left in 2000. And so there's, you know, there's that kind of, I find that the power
of echoes
that to the, and today are very interesting, not least because it gave birth to Hezbollah along the way. So in trying to deal with one terrorist threat, the Israelis created, or well, created the conditions in which another one emerged, and a far more powerful one than the PLO, because the PLO never really had, they had the backing of Palestinians in Lebanon, but they never really had broader support in Lebanon, which Hezbollah has, until fairly recently, at least enjoyed.
Yeah. And of course, the other actor in this story, which comes in later, is post-revolutionary Iran. So Iran has its Islamic Revolution in 1979. And before that, the Shah of Iran, although there was plenty of anti-Semitism in Iranian society, the Shah's people had quite close relations with Israel, didn't they?
They did. I mean, and Iran, I mean, so, yeah, sort of politically and intelligent in terms of intelligence. And the Iranians were supplying Israel with oil. And of course, that's what made, and the oil was arriving through the Straits of Tehran in the, you know, in the south up the Red Sea to Eilat. So, you know, that was, in a way, that's what made Israel so nervous about Egyptian attempts to take over the Sinai Peninsula, because of the strength of this you know, this connection with Iran. But all that changed in it changed in 79, except that, in a sense, I think, I mean, the real curdling of Israeli Iranian relations is much, much more recent. It's more like the, you know, it's the era of Ahmadinejad in 2005. Onwards. In fact, you know, of course, the Israelis helped the Iranians during the Iran-Iraq war, because they regarded Saddam as the bigger,
as the worst of the two options,
and the closer threat. So they provided the Iranians with the intelligence that Iran used to destroy a good chunk of the Iraqi air force on the ground. So, you know, it's complicated.
Yes, as ever. We've covered a lot of the ground that I wanted to, because it's that earlier period that I think people have less understanding of. But given your role as a historian, when you look at where we are now, and, you know, we're recording this on the 22nd of November, as it happens, there's a brief ceasefire in place to allow some hostages to be released, which, of course, I'm sure everyone would be happy to know about. But it doesn't feel like that's an end by any means to the conflict which has erupted in Gaza as a result of the Hamas's 7 October massacre. Stepping back a little to the possibility, or even the hope of a two-state solution, I have to say that the more I know, the less I can see a way to get there. What's your sense? Clearly, you're very familiar with the different sort of iterations that have existed over the years. But what you seem to have now is, obviously, the Gaza Strip is extremely dense and now in a state of real destruction. The West Bank has become a totally incoherent territory because of the expansion of settlements. Lots of places where Palestinians aren't allowed to go, and still less, you know, would be safe to do so. So is there anything that could be, even assuming a ceasefire, assuming, you know, grown-up leadership on both sides, is there anything that could even be used to stitch together a state out of those elements?
I think the short answer is no, unfortunately. I think I agree with you. I think people cling to the two-state solution as a phrase. It's a bit like the kind of orange life ring that you see on the, you know, on a pier. And I don't, you know, it's not viable. How would you do it? You've got to remove 500,000 Israeli settlers from the West Bank. That's a far bigger operation.
It's a second Nakba, you know.
The Israelis have to want to confront their own people. They had to do that in Gaza back in 2004 when they disengaged from Gaza. That was, you know, that was a few thousand people. It was, what, maybe 5,000?
Even then, as I recall, it was very controversial.
And there were people you know, accusing the Israeli government of being Nazis and so on. I mean, the passions ran incredibly high. And I mean, there's a mixture of people, you know, not all settlers in the West Bank are, you know, there because they believe that, you know, for religious reasons. Some of them simply want a, you know, a better home than they would have elsewhere in the country. But, you know, persuading people or coercing them to leave that territory to create a viable Palestinian state is just not, you know, it's not going to happen. And I think we don't do ourselves any favors by carrying on talking about the two-state solution now. I think the fact is it's a dead letter. And you know, but it's a convenient thing to say because it's something to say when if you're a politician and you're challenged on it, you can announce your belief in it, a bit like some sort of, you know, early Christian creed. So I don't see how it's going to happen. I'm very pessimistic about everything. And then as I look back, particularly now that I'm working on this very big book, hopefully not too big, but in terms of its sweep, it's going to cover 2,500 years of history. And I just sort of look and I think, well, you know, there are periods where one group of people has ruled this territory or another, but I don't see two sovereign groups of people sharing it. You know, it's different to say, you know, the Ottomans were there, and some people point to the Ottomans as a golden era, and it's certainly true that it was, you know, things were more peaceful most of the time at that point, but you know, the Ottomans were in charge from you know, distant Constantinople at that time. It wasn't two people both trying to, you know, to rule that part of the world. There's not going to be a peaceful solution any time soon that reconciles the coexistence of both these groups of people.
Well, on that sobering but I think very accurate note, James, thank you so much for talking to me and this sort of epic description of the history of Israel and Palestine.
Thank you for having me, Arthur.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Behind the Lines. If you found it interesting or useful, please share it or even give us a good review. And remember to subscribe so you don't miss another episode. I hope to have James Barr back again soon to talk in greater detail about the more recent period in the Israel-Palestine conflict. But that's all for now from this two-part special. Behind the Lines was produced by me, Arthur Snell, and the music is by Matty Benbrook.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.